all the reports are in so far, and the general word, I mean, since I seem to be some kind of a nodal point, is that, wow, this is fun. This is great. I'm so glad that, you know, that it has happened. So I guess the general overall feeling is on the positive side, and I'm certainly feeling it from here. I'm only going to take a second because I want to move right along into our presentations. And our presenters today, first Emily McBarrick, and then second comes Tobias Longa. And I think Tobias goes by his name Tobias more frequently than Clemens Tobias. And anyway, I'm going to move right into that. Emily, I first heard about because her work was very, very singularly striking. Actually, I didn't hear about her. I saw her work, right, the first thing, and I was attracted to it because of her exquisite craftsmanship. That's something that catches my eye as a kind of a minimum requirement. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, that I dislike people whose craftsmanship isn't exquisite, but there it was, and so I started looking. And the minute I looked into the work, I realized that I was in pretty deep. That you don't get Emily McBarrick by just taking a look. You have to try to accommodate yourself to the work, to relax, take a deep breath, and try to find the thread. And the thread is there. Her processes are I would say, influenced by, if I might take a leap, and I could be wrong, I would say it was influenced by a long tradition of printing. And then it came also to include a rather short tradition, that is a hundred years or so, of very contemporary thought. And then the next time I saw this book, I looked at it, I considered it. The next thing you know, I'm in London, and I'm visiting my friend Karen Blights, and there's Emily McBarrick again. And she was at this rather wonderful school called the Camberwell School. Was that correct?
Camberwell College of Art.
Anyway, so Emily is a writer, which didn't surprise me once I got into her work, a designer, and a book artist. And I think the writer comes first, really, with her. After graduating from Berkeley with high honors in comparative literature, wow, that's pretty great. I mean, I barely read English. In 1988, Emily apprenticed with Johanna Drucker at the Bow and Arrow Press, not far from Harvard Square, where Johanna might have been an assistant professor or something, and she had her hands on this incredibly small but, you know, beautifully located little press with, you know, bricks on the street. I mean, you might almost think you weren't in the United States. And has operated her presses, I believe that she names them Axel and Otto, in both commercial and experimental ventures since 1990. In 97, she earned a master's degree. That's when I was met her probably in 96 or so at Camberwell College in London. And she's now a professor of art at the professor of graphic design, assistant at the California College of Arts, formerly of Arts and Crafts, but they were able to get rid of that crafts word. Her work is, of course, I say of course, because I mean we wouldn't have invited her if she weren't of substance. Her works are in major museums and libraries, and you know, probably one of the toughest collections to get into in the United States is the Harvard University's Graphic Arts Collection, and I won't go into that in public. Recent shows include her Flicker Be Still, a solo exhibition of books and prints at 871 Fine Arts in San Francisco. If you get a chance to visit 871 Fine Arts in San Francisco, you will be pleasantly surprised. Adrian Fish, who is the proprietress of that establishment, has wonderful, wonderful books, and she supports Emily. I mean, not literally, but I mean, she certainly is a fan. And she's most recently collaborated with Johanna Drucker on a book called Graphic Design History, a Critical Guide, which I believe is a strong pedagogical tool, and it's one that was obviously needed. And so let's welcome Emily McBarry.
Hope you're enjoying my cosmic screensaver. Peter, thank you for that generous introduction, and thank you all for coming. I'm really impressed. My talk's going to focus on a single book, The Square, which I've just completed with the support of Granary Books and an excellent binding by John DeMeritt and his crew. I'll say a few things about the book's project and then discuss one of the concepts that shaped this project. The initial impulse behind The Square was not really initial. It was an urge I've had repeatedly to try to make sense of and make sensible the role of images in our lives, the nature of our desire for their stillness, their sameness, and containment. As I began again to work on this fixation, it gathered a few other familiar concerns, these relating to public space. Despite incursions of the virtual, public space still operates as a concrete, albeit disregarded, stage of everyday life, a place of palpable intersection between the particular and the general, between individual trajectories and social reproduction, between momentary enactments and the perpetuation of history. More than a vestige, public space... Oh, I forgot to show my first slide. This is the first... First attempts at thinking about the image yet again. More than a vestige, public space exposes a state of confrontation between this enduring physicality and modes of interaction, forms of attention that contradict it. A space unshared by people right next to one another. A non-place of dense holes, dislocated borders, and asynchronous eruptions. These recurrent thoughts, combined with my preoccupation with images, presented the following questions. Are increases in the complexity of personal space, as multiplied by handheld technologies, and the fragmentation of public space, as riddled by these technologies, making the wholeness of images more desirable, less possible, irrelevant? Can the patterning of everydayness still be sighted in a city street if the collectivity of its spaces and times is breaking down into heterogeneous intangibles? What happens to the notion of a whole if its parts do not add up? How can such a discontinuous sum be captured? I look to three main sources for direction from these points of departure. Francis Yates's analysis of the mnemonic function of allegorical imagery, Paul Virilio's characterizations of the placeless times and sedentary departures of screen-based networked living, and Henri Lefebvre's meditation on the discernible rhythms of a city as keys to the critical study of everyday life. Each of these sources informed a strain in the text I composed. A section in the book I made of them. And a meaning or referent for its title. In the first text, the square is the city square and the screen that displaces it. This text attempts to configure the paradoxes of public space as experienced by one of its users. Proximity to distance, sitting next to someone texting. Noisy absence, the piercing quality of someone else's cell phone call. And seated removal, the use of phones, headphones, and PDAs to leave the unbearable company of other unattended bodies behind. In the second text, the square is a picture's edge. This text introduces a figure called the keeper, who seeks just such a representation as the first text attempts. An allegory of our need to allegorize, the keeper is intent on capturing an afternoon corner as a scene, as if finding a moment's frame for it to fill will reveal a fullness otherwise elusive. As if this fullness, to which the image would be equal, could thus be preserved as a form of proof against loss. In the third text, the square is a unit in the grid of the daily, a block in a schedule inscribed in advance, but also lived in the moment and thus subject to the openness of presence. This presence, rather than any device of removal or capture, is offered as the possibility of grasping, though not keeping, a unit of lived experience. A capacity for immersive attention, this presence is evoked as the key to perceiving each element in an everyday scene as having its place, or rather its pulse, in a manifold arrangement that unfolds in time. Okay, so much for summary. In setting out to make this book, I wasn't interested in summarizable ideas. I wanted ideas embodied, embedded in book form. Ideas produced by details of a book's performance. So rather than continuing to describe all three of these texts abstractly, I'll try to advance on a single track that will take us to a more grounded discussion of the third text's central theme, rhythm. This theme supplied the square's conclusion in more ways than one and became its organizing principle. I think, too, that Lefebvre's conception of rhythm holds relevance and interest for a broader consideration of the book as a form of composition. In rhythm analysis, space-time and everyday life, Henri Lefebvre constructs a theoretical model and offers practical tips for apprehending the shape of everydayness, a quality that marks its objects so familiarly as to render them invisible. For political philosophers and sociologists, the beauty of Lefebvre's account of underlying social structures is that it does not reduce phenomenal aspects of their reproduction to the space of a monolithic diagram, but allows for particularity, diversity, chance, and change. Everyday life has, by definition, a repetitive organization. For Lefebvre, its repetitions produce rhythms of work, sleep, transit, consumption, etc. Each distinguishable rhythm of traffic on a street, of sales in a corner store, of steps on a sidewalk, of items on the news, interacts with others. This interaction includes macro and micro rhythms that may be organic or mechanical, continuous or discontinuous, cyclical or linear. Each rhythm is marked by a frequency made up of intense and light times that recur with some regularity, according to some law. Stops, silences, blanks, and intervals belong to a rhythm's pattern. The composition produced by these rhythms can be heard by an attentive listener whose own rhythms of heart, lungs, or appetite, just to name the physical, will be the source of her relative sense of tempo and measure, her metronome. Okay, so what does all this have to do with artist books? The page, like the everyday, is a repetitive format. But when Lefebvre says repetitive, he means repetitive with differences. If only because recurrence happens over time, but also because it is subject to alternation and alterity, to encounters and events. According to this conception of repetition, the page becomes a setting, a measure, whose very consistency enables the perception of variation, of change and its significance. For anyone interested in the book as a sequential form, this expanded understanding of repetition is key. if repetition with differences is the baseline of sequential meaning, how does attention paid to sequence affect the status of any given page as a field of visual composition? It would seem to place the page on par with a film still, to make of it an image of stopped time, of stopped book. Yet for Lefebvre, our conception of the image harbors twin pretenses, both false. A pretense to simultaneity, the shared moment of an image's contents, and a pretense to identity, the image as an exact repetition of itself. The latter pretense to identity or exact repetition is canceled by any book that marks itself as a sequence. In such a book, the page is perceived as a temporary fragment, as a part played in passing. As for the first pretense to simultaneity or temporal unity, as Lefebvre's observer discovers, not only is nothing static, but everything moves in its own time. Look at those lawns, those trees, he writes. To your eyes, they situate themselves in a permanence, in a spatial simultaneity, in a coexistence. But look harder and longer. This simultaneity is only apparent. Listen attentively. You thus perceive that each plant, each tree, has its own rhythm, made up of several. According to this conception of spatial composition, the page is a potentially heterogeneous terrain whose different zones, while intersecting, may advance at their own rates, multiplying the temporalities of the book, itself no longer understood as a unity, but, like the tree, as a rhythm made up of several. To Lefebvre's analyst, most rhythms reveal themselves to be made up of an ensemble of rhythms. So when he says rhythm, he means polyrhythm. Applied to the book as a textual form, this concept of polyrhythm offers an alternative to the expected one-to-one ratio of text to book. Implicit claims of oneness and completeness that attach culturally to the book package our understanding of textuality itself. Breaking through this package opens the possibility not only of a diverse text or a composite book, but of a dynamic and multifaceted relationship between the two. The analyst, writes Lefebvre, seeks to grasp a moving but determinate complexity. What better description of a book that not only produces meaning through sequence, but takes advantage of its graphically divisible, structurable, governable spaces to orchestrate this meaning? The word determinant recalls an earlier phrase to which I'd like to return for a moment. Good job. Markers of everyday space and time, Lefebvre writes, recur with some regularity, according to some law. For the critic of everyday life, putting a finger on the logic of a rhythm's determination is part of the analytic project, the diagnosis of society's ills. For the book artist, law is the level at which design itself can mean, the level at which a graphic system can be built, a formal language developed. Rules constraining style, layout, and production generate conventions that not only tacitly establish and carry meaning through the repetition of a form, but can modulate this meaning through persistence, resistance, deviation, and shifts in the use of this form. The rhythm analyst, Lefebvre writes, comes to listen to a house, a street, a town, as an audience listens to a symphony. In putting the square together, I tried to follow his example. I thought if I looked harder and longer, if I listened for the overlapping repetitions of the street, I might discover their aggregate form and be able to translate it in some way. I used found sound. and found words to compose my translations. I chose type and other fonts of calendars, dots, numbers, to structure and code these texts, and I clipped figures from video stills to populate and animate them. To devise graphic norms that would distinguish and relate all of these elements, I began with alignment. The square's pages are ruled in part by a microgrid generated by the modules of a perpetual calendar kit. Horizontally, this grid provides 14 points of potential alignment to repeat a position or produce a recognizable interval between positions. Not every position is determined by the grid, but when it is adhered to, phrases or images may be coordinated, given a cadence to cross a page, or both. But things don't really get moving until a page is turned. In some cases, the square marks the page edge as a break by running a line right over it. Connection and its opposite thus coincide. So this, what you're seeing is two sides of the same page. Over time, page breaks measure graphic forms of rhythm that move through the book. At a macrorhythmic level, the square's three sections not only vary in length, but reset formal rules. From one section to another, some graphic principles change and some persist. Perhaps the clearest example of meaningful rhythm at this level comes when what had been established as the treatment of section openers, the appearance of the grid source as a printed background, becomes the treatment of regular pages in section 3. So after an interval of 28 pages, then an interval of 16 pages, this treatment starts arriving on one page after another in section 3. A marker of classification thus enters the passing moment, a sign of the rhythm analyst's immersion, or a signal of this last section's status as the book's coda. Finally, there's one rhythmic element that progresses through all three sections, marked by variations in color and texture as it goes. Its increments string the book together as a sum. Of the square's 64 pages, the first and last are single, as in any book. This leaves 31 spreads to count off the number of days in most months. The periodic non-appearance of this count's digits delivers the book's most salient version of silent beats, or intermittency. So much for graphic form. For the time remaining, I'd like to test the concept of polyrhythm on the interplay of texts that run through the pages of the square and compounded organize the book as a whole. The first two sections of the square are made up of multiple typographically distinct texts and subtexts. Section 1 has 3. That's 1, 2, and 3. Section 2 has 5. Of these, 3 are new. And 2 carry over in modified form from section 1. The gutter text reappears with interpolations, and the cell phone text recurs in giant one-word fragments. In section 3, the gutter text comes into its own and becomes the text, although it too takes multiple typographic forms. I masked some of the pages I just showed in order to highlight the appearance of these different texts. In order to show where and how they tend to meet, and to demonstrate the way one text's phrasing maps onto the book's collective sequence. I'd like to end by reading this text, the gutter text, or maybe call it the curb text, because the gutter sounds not quite in the gutter. Curb sounds better. The curb text, accompanied by a short video showing its passage through the book. Before I do, a few words of conclusion. To me, the book is an apt form in which to experience the image looked at harder and longer. In a book, any point can become a point of entry into time and change. Any space can be configured to multiply and relate elements. Any number of levels of meaning are composable. Okay, so I'm going to try and do this reading. I apologize in advance for the resolution of the video. And don't worry, it's short. Let's see how we do with this. Let's see. So I'm going to be reading that tiny text in the gutter. Listen. There's nothing to hold. Nothing stops. The settings of the world are hidden in the frequencies of everyday audibility. Listen, there's nothing to hold, no thing to be known by sight of an instant stopped. Nothing stops. The settings of the world are hidden in the frequencies of everyday audibility. Gestures of the street repeat, stepping, speeding, left and right, the same and not the same. Their steady plot is heard in time, scored by featureless custom, itself as sealed as shame. Whole blocks list this apprenticeship, group habit grids each wrestle, and rations the unforeseen. Still, a chart of the daily will stick to its cardboard. The only measure of life is a beat. Your own stride or breath is entry to every form of ongoingness, not just matters, of course, but within them, points of ruin, seeds of difference, cycles of sleep and catastrophe. The rise and fall of a passing car, the school day's drill through the working week, the fade of skies and plastic signs, the tappings of trans everything. You are here. Listen, there's nothing to hold, no thing to be known by sight of an instant stopped. Nothing stops. The settings of the world are hidden in the frequencies of everyday audibility. You are here, in the western flow of glances, in the spray of each new engine, at the waiting for the lights and mercy of the pigeons, behind a tagged van slowing, above the white sweep of an arrow, and lower a tapering train, on the site of the unrecorded, at the back of a humming signal, alongside the pull of a buffering mixture, on a seat of paused announcement, in the time of a slight wind, in the air of its coming and lasting, in the presence of your others, on the basis of unspokenness, in the secrecy of compliance, between moves. A square opening emits a row of upright histories. There now, there. Their serial strokes arrive pre-counted, exploding in air and up for rehearsal. You are here, where only their rhythm adjoins the day. Gestures of the street repeat, stepping, speeding, left and right, the same and not the same. Their steady plot is heard in time, scored by featureless custom, itself as sealed as shame. Whole blocks list this apprenticeship, loop habit grids each rustle and rations the unforeseen. Still, a chart of the daily will stick to its cardboard. The only measure of life is a beat. And that's it.
Well, we have time for a few questions, and then we'll move on. Please, we'll move segue right away. But first, any questions?
Well, if we're behind, I'm happy to answer questions later. Yes. Steve. Hi, Steve.
Would you describe your method of composition, the cut-ups you do, and some of the notes that you presented?
Yeah, so the cut-ups, the cut-up text is a way that I've been writing forever. Yeah, it's just the way that I write, which is when I'm trying to think of what I'm trying to say, I look for existing words, cut them out, paste them up, arrange them mostly according to part of speech, and then those paste chords become the source for the text that I compose. And you can tell on some of these that, I mean, once I've figured out a phrase, you know, that I'm ready to write, I might end up literally making a word. You might ask why, what's the point at that point of using a cut-up. So this is a really telling slide, that the main point for me is just to externalize the process of writing and involve it in some material. So it's not about any kind of pure procedural, conceptual approach that most other cut-up writing might be. And then the other, this is a really familiar way for me to write. This stuff, these transcriptions, this is new. This is the source of the cell phone text, and I just went around transcribing cell phone conversations and used, you know, whole chunks of other people's lives. And then this one, you'll see how appalling my handwriting is. This is me writing down everything that I can distinguish in a tape that I made at the corner of 24th and Mission. Actually, it's me writing notes as I'm listening to it as well, just to make sure I can remember what all the sources of sound were. So this particular project had a couple of other ways of writing than my usual mode. Peter, we should probably move on. Okay.
So, Jonathan?